These wonderful talks that have gone before, there's a common theme, a lesson learned that's there. You see, some things haven't changed at all. My wife, Carlene, would attest to. So I want to share a little bit about being one of the first entomologists, Navy entomologists in Vietnam, and give you some overview, some anecdotes, and some lessons learned. I was one of 14 Navy entomologists that were assigned to 1st or 3rd Marine Divisions. I was the first one in the Preventive Medicine section of the 1st Marine Division, 24 staff. For those of you that are not familiar with the military, the PMSs, the PMUs, operated kind of like a mini health department. They were a general support element of the 1st Marine Division. The entomology branch had myself and four preventive medicine technicians. The PMTs were really the backbone of this whole operation. And we kind of, our workload kind of broke down into surveillance, control, epidemiology, and education. Both the 1st and 3rd Marine Divisions were the northernmost corps assigned to Vietnam. So the 1st ran from just below the DMZ to about 100 miles south, just below Da Nang. Our unit had a main facility in Da Nang. We had a forward unit in Phu Bai. And these were characteristic of the kind of coastal foothill areas, extensive fields of rice paddies, and lots of little small farms. In the north, where the Indian country was, Con Tien, the famous caisson, more mid-elevation mountainous areas covered with scrub or dense forest and dominated by rivers and some seepage areas. I want to mention the Tet Offensive. This is the 40th anniversary of the so-called Tet Offensive. The enemy with orders to crack the sky and shake the earth. I love that phrase. That's got to be something to send your football team out to play. Crack the sky and shake the earth, and they did. 1 month after I got in country, on the 31st of January, there were surprise enemy attacks on throughout Vietnam in 100 cities and military bases. And if you look at the numbers that we lost in Vietnam, some 58,000 over about a 10-year period, 30% of those occurred during 1968 from the Tet Offensive. It was a turning point in the war politically, but it also impacted us trying to provide preventive medicine services to troops out in the field. The vector-borne disease threats, except for malaria, were not as bad as we thought they would be. We recorded 1,200 cases of malaria in 1st Marine Corps troops during 1968. That number is way low. Most of the cases were falciparum. The rest were vivax and some mixed. And the hyperendemic areas were in the highland mountainous areas. And the endemicity was extremely variable, in large part because of this mobile parasite group that consisted of the enemy and the local population that was very mobile. So that reservoir was moving all of the time. We first started doing surveys of 1st Marine Division units. We looked at surveillance, at control, at their malaria discipline and their training. And they all failed. In large part because the table allowances did not have the right equipment, the right supplies, and not the right insecticides. We found some unusual things. For example, at one Marine Corps motor pool, we found them using 57% concentrate malathion for engine oil. They'd run out of engine oil, so somebody said, well, just use that stuff. can't imagine. The other thing we discovered when we looked at the places that had the malaria problems, it wasn't the sugar base camps along the coast and the deltas. It was in the foothills and the mountains, which also were owned by the enemy. And we had kind of the usual tools at that time for control, the hand compressed sprayers, the Dynafog units, the so-called Army mechanical cold fogger, and of course helicopter aerial dispersal. We loaned some of those Dynafog units out to Marine units. We stopped when one of them came back with white enamel paint in the insecticide reservoir. I can't imagine what they were thinking of painting a wall with a fogger. The cold fogger, we figured for every hour we operated it, we'd need 2 or 3 hours for maintenance. An aerial dispersal by helicopter was a disappointment, not only because of malfunctions, but the vast, I mean, that little bit of what happens to be Phenthion granules coming out of the helicopter is just a drop in that huge rice paddy bucket. I mean, that's a job for the Air Force. It's also hard to find pilots that are willing to fly in the small orange envelope and doing swath widths in a grid pattern, slowly moving. So we could characterize the malarious areas as you can't get into them to do to treat the breeding sites. The roads, for the most part, were impassable to things like foggers. It was really hard to compete for aircraft and pilots to go do a spray mission. Hostile fire threats were a problem, and the other thing was because of helicopters, our troops were extremely mobile. There were no defined fronts in the war, and a lot of it involved guerrilla tactics. So the question was for me, well, okay, now what? And now what was personal protective measures, which somehow was a disappointment. It felt like I'd only been on active duty for a year and a half, and it felt like as an entomologist I should be able to wave a magic wand and make this stuff go away. As always been mentioned, command support's critical. We got good support. The only one problem was that one of the Marine generals came down with malaria, which was often pointed out to us. It probably was just resistant, but not a good thing. And one of the things that would not have surprised me now, but surprised me then, was that there was not a unit in either the 1st or 3rd Marine Divisions that knew how much malaria incidents they had. The whole system had broken down. They worked with numbers instead of names. The closing diagnosis was never reported back to the units. And it wasn't until June until we had that fixed. And amazing enough, the rates went up. We did assessments, interviews on non-malaria patients and malaria patients, so we had some idea of how the malaria discipline program was. The Marines at the time were taking the chloric and primacon tablets. The Army added Dapsone to that. It's critical that you get at least 90% compliance, and we had 60% that were not taking them on a regular basis. Part of that was an attitude that if I got malaria, maybe I'll be evacuated to Comrade Bay or back home. The other problem we had was that we had drug resistance in chloroquine. The drug was only effective about 60 to 80% of the time. Guy right there's got a bottle of repellent in his hat band. when I first saw that, I thought, oh my God, isn't that great? The system's working. And then this Navy chief said, sir, he's got that in there because DEET has alcohol in it, and it's a good way to start fires. I said, oh, okay. Only about 50% of the folks we talked to said they used repellent adequately and applied it correctly. And if they used it at all, it was usually when there were pest mosquitoes were abundant. The attitudes about the repellent was interesting. Some said the VC could detect it. The USDA lab in Gainesville tested that and said, well, that's true if they're about 12 inches from you. And if they're only 12 inches away, you're in a world of you-know-what anyway. And something that still persists is that if you buy your repellent from the PX, it's going to be better than that stuff you put in the olive drab bottle. Now this is not a Marine Corps setting. This is actually the Air Force. They always knew how to live better than us. Bed nets, if they were used at all, they were used in secure bases. There were people literally got Purple Hearts trying to get out of their bed net when incoming started. And if you've got them tucked in, they're impossible to retreat from. And in the hot summer months, when the air was so humid, it was hard to breathe. And if you're being shot at, it's not easy. Not that you can't do it. Field Marshal Colonel Sims proved you could, but it's really hard to get the troops to roll down sleeves and button their collars and do all that stuff. I want to break a minute and just talk about some of the other bugs in battle. We probably had a dozen different insects and arthropods that we dealt with. Has been kind of common throughout these excellent talks. Filth flies were extremely prevalent, and sometimes it felt like Vietnam was just one big garbage dump. And it's amazing how our Marines and Army personnel could live with poop all over everywhere. I mean, it's just, that's another common thing that's in these talks. I don't care how tough a Marine was, nothing would animate him the more than waking up in the middle of the night in a bunker with a 16-inch centipede going down the back of their neck. The centipedes, the Scolopendra genus, loved bunkers, and I'm sure their Marines still telling stories about those. Lots of venomous snakes in the country. We had snake bites, but most of them came from the bamboo, green bamboo viper, a beautiful snake, which fortunately had a very weak hemotoxic venom. I have a great story an Army major told me about a soldier who had snake bite of the tongue. And these four guys, these four PMTs are standing around a little tiny live trap with a rat in it. And they're waiting for me to take the pictures so they can go give the rat to a Vietnamese rock python that we had as a pet. But I want to mention the live traps because it's my favorite story. If the Marines found one of our traps, they'd either stamp on it, or they'd open up and let the animal out. Or they'd take their DEET repellent, or lighter fluid, and they'd squirt it on the animal. Then they'd take a match and light it, and open up the trap and watch it run off in a blaze. And true story, they almost had a disaster when one of the rats ran into an ammo bunker and died just short of the flare locker. I briefed a Marine Corps general who was head of food service for the Marine Corps in Washington, D.C. I told him the story. I got done and he said, would you tell me that story again about the rats? I've got a cat next door neighbor has that I don't like very well. Another favorite story, and this, for those of you who are not familiar with the military, back in Vietnam, this is an outdoor head. But instead of, you know, one big pit, these barrels would be inside under the holes. The barrels aren't, but the Marines haven't noticed. They're still pooping on the deck. The door is open. The mess hall is 25 yards away. This is 3rd LBTs, the Amtraks. They were in bad country. They were taking a lot of literally flak. The door's wide open here. Every morning the barrels are supposed to be pulled out and burned off. And if they're not burned off, you literally get a barrel of maggots. And if you're a medical entomologist, you love this stuff. I mean, disease and pestilence is what gets us going. And it was just wonderful. But you know, when I went up to brief the corpsman who was in charge of this, it turns out he'd just gotten off a night patrol. They'd taken casualties. And when I looked at him, that's what his eyes looked back. I'll never forget that. And I started to ream him out, and then I stopped and realized, you know, this just isn't that important. And what I learned was, in preventive medicine, you can go aboard a Navy ship or shore establishment, point out problems, write them up, and leave. That's the easy part. The hard part's recognizing that, okay, these folks have problems which they can't control. What can I do to try to help them out? In this case, the PMTs volunteered to come shop from the Seabees and get some screening and tools and come back and help them fix the problem. Great lesson. It's a wonderful Army photographer shot. One of the very unexpected things that happened early on was after Tet Offensive was kind of at its peak, both the Army and the Marine Corps had instances where they were not able to retrieve their dead out of the battlefield. And they do everything they can not to have that happen. So one day, Gray's Registration, which was next door to our unit, came over and asked said they had a problem, could I come and take a look? And it turns out, when they were able to retrieve the bodies out of the battlefield, it was 7 to 10 days later, and you can expect what they looked like. I mean, the natural process of decomposition was going on. And the maggots and beetles the body bags were just swarming with those folks. And they said, you know, we can't process these bodies and get them to the morgue. Could you do something? And we ended up spraying with dichlorobos and closing up the bags, and within 24 hours it was okay to go in. One of the striking things that I saw that surprised me so much was the fact that most of these folks had comic books with them. It just, the incongruity of dying in battle with a comic book on you is just amazing. You know, everybody that's been this route, you learn something every day. But the key things were, for me, aerial dispersal was not did not work as well as I'd hoped. Personal protective measures became far more important, but here we were with repellents that were not very good, and with suppressive drugs were also not very good. So what I end up with, the final lesson. For somebody who'd been in the Navy for such a short time, this kind of experience is a great way to start your career. I mean, I survived it, I wasn't hurt, and it was pivotal in that I really discovered what was important in our mission, and was able to take advantage of some of those things, including working on repellents. So I want to end with, on the first Saturday of December, we were all anxiously waiting the famous Army-Navy football game. And wouldn't you know it, the Army won. And somebody said, okay, that's all right, because Navy never loses a game, they just run out of time. Which is what I've done. Thank you very much.